Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, hepatitis B hits Asian Pacific Islander and Black American communities particularly hard. Now, a bill just signed by Governor Newsom will require hospitals to offer testing for Hep B and C. We'll learn more. But first, what does it take to save a language? Last month, Marie Wilcox of Woodlake, California, the last known fluent speaker of the indigenous language Wuchumni, passed away. Dozens of indigenous languages across California are disappearing or have only a few fluent speakers left. We meet people committed to revitalizing these languages right after this news. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Marie Wilcox of Woodlake, California, passed away last month. She was the last known fluent speaker of the indigenous language Wuchumni. Before she died, Wilcox dedicated herself to preserving the language by putting together a Wuchumni dictionary and recording herself speaking. Here she is in a New York Times profile video by Emmanuel Vaughn Lee. Similar efforts are underway for other indigenous languages with few fluent speakers. We look this hour at what it takes to save these languages. And joining me now is Phil Albers, Cultural Activities Coordinator for the Kurukh Tribe, Northeastern Humboldt County. Phil Albers, thanks so much for joining us. Hi, Phil, are you there?
Hi, yeah, thank you. Aiki, that is the way Phil Albers, Nakarukwara, Panamnikanikri, Istinakipis, Pritiches, Much Ihan Sasi Karulusi, Nanike Chikiav, Terlin, Kurukasni Achicha. So, yeah, my name is Phil Albers. I live up in Orleans, California, a member of the Kurukh tribe. I work for the Kurukh Tribal TANF program, and I'm really happy to be involved today.
Well, we're really happy to have you here as well. Thanks so much. Joining Phil is Jennifer Malone, a member of the Wuchumni tribe and also daughter of Marie Wilcox. Jennifer, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I have to express just my condolences for your recent loss, and so appreciative of you being here, given that it is so recent. I know you worked with your mom to write this Wuchumni dictionary. How long did this take? What was your role in that process with your mom?
My role was to help her edit it and help her create sentences, because we did put sentences in there with the words so that you could understand and try to learn a phrase when you're learning the language. So I was her driver and her caretaker.
She really dedicated many of the last years of her life to this. Why was it so important to her?
Well, to start with, she said that she wanted someone to talk to. And so we were all eager to learn so that we would be able to talk to her in the language. And it was her connection with her grandma that raised her. And she just really enjoyed speaking the language, singing in the language, praying in the language.
She clearly understood the importance and gravity of keeping it.
Yes.
Do you think her status as the last fluent speaker would ever affect her emotionally? Like, she would really take that in?
Yes, because she felt like she was end of the trail, you know, and with us working with her, it just made her happy.
Phil Albers, it was wonderful to hear you use Kurukh to introduce yourself. What are the ways that you use the Kurukh language now to try to keep it alive? Is this one of them? Phil Albers, are you there?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry about that. I have a little bit of connectivity issue sometimes. I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Yeah. I just was saying that you yourself, it's also really important to you to keep the Kurukh language really thriving. And I was just asking how you use it. I was struck by how you introduced yourself immediately using the language. Is that one of the ways that you really keep it out there?
It is. It is. I use it quite frequently at home. I won't say in a immersion or 100% way, but I do use it quite frequently with a lot of personal phrases, and I use it with my children. I use it in my work. So I use it on a daily basis and not just within certain places. Like my home or my office, or even bound to my presentations, even at the store in possibly sometimes Eureka, which is nearly 2 hours one way drive. I will speak in Kurukh in the public, sometimes directly to complete strangers. And most of the time I get a response. They say, "Is that Chinese?" But, and I say no, and I let them know. And then from there, I'm just able to incorporate that into how I interact.
You really had a drive at an early age to learn this, but I understand that it was actually hard to convince your grandmother, for example, to speak it to you. Why was she reluctant to do that?
Yes, that's accurate. She was very resistant even, where she would say, "You don't need to learn this language." And I believe that was primarily because of her experience at boarding schools and her experience growing up and living in Siskiyou County area, where speaking your native indigenous language was a very bad thing and serious consequences for that would happen. And then there was that element of her wanting to protect her grandchildren and her community that she cares about, but also still having that very real, very present traumatic response after years of conditioning and abuse and such hurtful times while she was young.
What changed her mind, and what has it been like for you to learn the language and speak it so frequently? What does that do for you?
Well, what I think one of the largest factors for her was a lot of my other family, my cousins and siblings, really began supporting each other in our own efforts. And I really feel like it was my nieces who came forward, and I'm sorry, not my nieces, my younger cousins. I think of them as sisters and nieces, but to go forward with language learning, and then it became a widely accepted community effort, where even distant extended family members and close family friends were beginning to reach out to her. And she finally felt like there was some safety in embracing the indigenous language, that she had a treasure within her that she could share that would not hurt people, but would actually help them. And for me, that's exactly what it does. Being able to put together thoughts, express my emotions and ideas in that Kurukh language helps me connect and resonate with more closely with the land that I'm living on and that I'm from, as well as how I internally process things around me.
Jennifer Malone, similarly, what is your relationship with the Wachumni language now? I know that you are often called upon to give offerings or prayers in your community.
Yes, I'm still working with Owens Valley Bishop and teaching classes on Mondays and Thursdays. And I reached out to our family because they really understand now how important this was to Mom, asking them if they want to join us and just really trying to reach out to all of our family members. So I've still keeping it going and doing our cultural activities in different areas with using our language with our materials and baskets and different things like that. So we are still keeping it going, and I'm working with our youth to keep it going, and working with my great grandson. He's 4 years old and he's really catching on good.
We're talking with Jennifer Malone and Phil Albers about breathing new life into Indigenous languages. And I want to bring into the conversation now Zachary O'Hagan, a postdoctoral scholar in the Department of Linguistics and manager of the California Language Archive at UC Berkeley. Zachary O'Hagan, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a sense of how many languages in California are considered quote unquote endangered, and what often led to this?
It's a difficult number to arrive at with precision just because there are so many unique cases around the state. But I think to give a bit of context, that's often considered to be the case that there, from Baja California up to what is now more or less the Oregon border, there were somewhere upwards of 80 indigenous languages spoken in the region, which is approximately a third of the linguistic diversity in all of North America. It's concentrated just in Baja and what was formerly called Alta California. And the majority of those languages now no longer have what we would refer to as first language speakers. And depending on exactly which of these regions speakers of a language might have found themselves in, processes of suppression of and violence against speakers of these languages may have occurred earlier or later. So in areas that were affected by the Spanish Franciscan mission system, that process began in the late 18th century with the founding of the San Diego mission, for example, in 1769. For languages in more northern California and in eastern California and the Sierras, they were less affected by the mission system, though not unaffected. And that process really, that process of suppression and violence really began with the Gold Rush and the annexation of California and later California statehood. And both of those periods long predate, I think, what is recently becoming more well known to people as this period of removal of children into boarding schools by the U.S. government.
Right. We're talking with Zachary O'Hagan, a postdoctoral scholar at the Department of Linguistics at UC Berkeley. And we're talking about how Californians are working to preserve indigenous languages. More after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're learning about efforts to fortify indigenous languages with few first speakers left. And we're joined by Phil Albers, Cultural Activities Coordinator for the Karuk Tribe in northeastern Humboldt County. Jennifer Malone, member of the Wachumni Tribe. Her mother, Marie Wilcox, was the last fluent speaker of Wachumni and created a dictionary before she died just last month. Also with us is Zachary O'Hagan, a postdoctoral scholar at the Department of Linguistics and manager of the California Language Archive at UC Berkeley. You, our listeners, are with us as well. And I want to ask you, if you speak an indigenous language, do you worry about it dying out? And how do you hold on to the practice of one? Do you consider yourself a language or culture keeper generally? What do you do? How do you do it? Give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or get in touch on Twitter or Facebook. Zachary O'Hagan, I'm wondering if you can tell us what it takes to actually save a language? What are the processes? Because I wonder, if there aren't any first speakers left, what is the hope of maintaining and ultimately revitalizing it?
I think there are two different kinds of situations. One, the one that you're asking about, and I'll just briefly allude to the kind of situation that Phil Albers was talking about just a second ago, where there are still first language speakers. And I just want to highlight that, you know, a major effort that is necessary to maintain languages in those cases is to work through the difficulties that that speakers had early in life that prevented them from speaking these languages later in life, when he was speaking about his grandmother. In cases where there may no longer be first language speakers, this is an area where other kinds of actors come into the situation. That might be linguists, that might be anthropologists, that might be indigenous community members who recorded aspects of language before there were no first language speakers anymore. And in particular, this is an area where archives can come into play. So materials which might be written records of languages, or sound recordings, or more recently, video recordings that were can have been created by many different kinds of people. Those are often stored in archives, and the work there is facilitated by people like linguists in creating tools like dictionaries that are not too technical and accessible by people who want to learn a language. Descriptions of grammar that, again, are not too linguistically technical and able to be used by people who want to learn languages. And I think the crucial bit is for these materials to be either introduced for the first time or reintroduced into the communities where they were made, often in a period where things were typically extracted and not always returned to community members.
So then is the California Language Archive really working to try to collect these materials from private owners?
So we work with a few different kinds of stakeholders. We work with, we have a large collection of things that we have inherited over the years from everyone from Berkeley graduate students to academic linguists from other institutions to sometimes Indigenous community members who have opted to archive things with the archive here. And more recently, we have been working to, in effect, reach out to especially academic linguists who may have created materials but not archived them, and to on behalf of these sorts of language efforts to better collect that and make increase awareness about materials that exist still in private hands, which is quite common.
Let me bring Karina Lunagiri into the conversation, a board member for Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, which is an organization focused on preserving and restoring California's Indian languages. Karina Lunagiri, thanks so much for joining us.
So good morning. Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate having you. And I wonder, what are the things that the advocates of Indigenous California Language Survival are doing now to try to basically do the kinds of things that Zachary O'Hagan's department is also trying to do, which is to really understand the importance and to really revitalize these Indigenous languages?
Right. So what's great is that ICLS is a board completely with California Indian, you know, language champions. Mm. So it's run by Native people and people actually in the field. So we have our board of directors who are participants in their language programs. Many of them are teachers. Many of them are part of the master apprentice program, where they pair a master speaker with an apprentice. A lot of them have, including myself, come from a community where we have no living speakers. And so we're using archival material for language revitalization. So there's a really good mix of group with experience and knowledge, and actually, you know, in the field and understand, you know, the struggle that we all face. So there's several different programs. We have the Breath of Life program, which is we have the workshop every 2 years, and it's in collaboration with UC Berkeley. And we invite California Indian communities to come in, and we pair them with a linguistic partner, and they basically get a crash course in linguistics. They learn how to do archival research, They learn how to decipher their materials, how to use their materials. And by the end of the week, they produce a project. And so they go home with this wealth of knowledge. And me, myself, I was part of the first Breath of Life program that they had back in 1996. And the linguist I was paired with was actually a student at the time. And we've been working together for 26 years. And so it's also about, you know, networking and and creating these, you know, lifelong, you know, relationships that really help languages grow. So in my case, I was, our language hadn't been spoken for 70 years. And so after 26 years of work and working with our community and with the linguist, you know, we published a dictionary, I think it was like in 1996. It's an open source dictionary. We teach language classes. We're really moving and pushing, you know, pushing forward. But it does stem back to the program that ICLS provides. They do wonderful work as well as other programs.
I was struck by the anecdote that you are currently providing classes, ICLS is the Indigenous California Language Survival, and that you have elders, some in their 70s, learning the language for the first time in their lives.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's great. It's just such a joy to see them, you know, and I would have thought with technology, it might have been a little bit more difficult for, you know, our elders to log on. But and the majority of our students are actually, you know, people in their 60s and 70s and even 80s. So Wow. It's yeah, and it's great because they're speaking their language, you know, for the first time, and you know, they're really enjoying it. And I'm just glad that we're able to provide something like that, you know, for them.
Phil Albers, I understand that becoming a father really factored into your drive to speak Karuk. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the experience has been of using it with your family, trying to teach it to your kids?
Yes, that really was a big selling point for me. I am a success story, I guess you could say, with ICLS. Early on, once I got through some of the barriers with finding dedicated master speakers, I became an apprentice in the Master Apprentice Language Learning Program. And I actually went from a beginner vocabulary-based speaker to a fluent speaker. And actually now I am a master speaker that I have an apprentice. But that sparked and came from once I learned that I was having my first son, I looked in the mirror and I said, I have 9 months to be a fluent speaker so that I can teach my son Karuk for his first language. And that was a driving motivation, not only for myself and for what I perceive as one of the most beneficial ways to raise my children, but also for the entire community and all of those family members and elders and ancestors that have gone on before me. And they lived through the scary, traumatic times of being Indigenous, knowing your language and culture, and they survived it down. And I really felt a personal responsibility to honor them by trying to instill that within my children and my own family. So that was a lot of the motivation, and that was successful for the first 4 or 5 years. My son primarily spoke Karuk almost 100% of the time. And then once he got into a Head Start system that was not a Karuk immersion Head Start system, it was a tribal Head Start, a Yurok tribal Head Start, which was great for incorporating language, but was not a Yurok immersion school. He learned very quickly that he needed to use English to effectively communicate outside of our family.
Yes. Though what I think you're really bringing to light is just how language maintenance is so intertwined with cultural maintenance, it sounds like, Phil.
Yeah, I really believe that. And I'm not only referring to a traditional cultural context, that also includes a contemporary cultural context where we still do and can still go gather acorns or work on making yewood bows or basketry and weaving, hunting, all of these things, these actions that we can still do today. Granted, there are different tools and different processes for that. They're still cultural acts because we are still the Kadu people.
Yeah.
And that is still part of our culture, and language being interwoven there and having such a strong relationship is critical.
Kenina, you've also talked about how language maintenance is intertwined with your own sense of identity. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I learned really, you know, young that that language really is your identity. It's so tied with it. It's tied with our worldview. When I was in the fourth grade, right, we all had to do these mission projects. And I remember telling a classmate, well, you know, I'm, you know, from the missions, I'm Indian from the missions. And she said, oh, if you're Indian, then speak it. And I was totally stumped because I couldn't speak my language. So something about that really stuck with me, where I really realized that it's tied with identity, so closely tied. So it was something that always stayed in back of my mind. And, you know, throughout my life, I even as a young person, I said, I'm going to, you know, at some point, you know, learn my language.
Yeah. Let me go to caller Kim in Peninsula. Hi, Kim. Thanks for waiting.
Yes. Hello. Thank you. I live out toward the coast, South Coast in San Mateo County. And there's a community here of farm workers that come from Oaxaca. They speak Chitino, which is an indigenous language there in Oaxaca. And I'm a database background, and I wrote a web interface for a dictionary. So really it's for me, so I could sort of take a stab at coming to groups with Chitino. But it turned out that, you know, there are quite a few indigenous language varieties in southern Mexico. Chitino is one group, Zapotec another, and then Mixtec. And I was wondering, is there a community organization or some group that get in touch for these languages that we've been talking about here in California?
Zachary O'Hagan, do you know?
I think I missed a crucial part of the caller's question about what kind of organization he's looking for, but
introductions to communities that speak indigenous languages. I have the software that I wrote for a web interface for a dictionary is really more of a platform, so it could be used for any language, and so I'm interested in talking to people about that.
I could refer you. I'm not as familiar with the Chitino community in California, but there is a set of actually indigenous Chitino linguists that have been based at off and on at the University of Texas at Austin over many years. And I would refer to you to their Chitino project and contacts that they probably have with Chitino communities around the country.
Well, Kim, thanks for the question. And let me actually go to another Kim in San Jose. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I just have a comment, actually. My daughter goes to university in North Wales, and the county that her university is in has a 60% native Welsh-speaking, 60% native Welsh speakers in her county in Wales. And I think I just wanted to highlight that Wales is an incredible success story for revitalizing an indigenous language and bringing it back into general use. Many of her classes are bilingual in Welsh. Every sign is primarily in Welsh and is translated into English. Everything has to go out in Welsh and English. And you can even get a teaching certificate as a bilingual Welsh speaker.
Hmm.
So it's really a success story on the planet of maintaining, of revitalizing an indigenous language.
Well, Kim, thanks for sharing that story. Yael tweets, please encourage listeners to upload audio, video, and text content to Wikisource and Wikimedia Commons to ensure it is archived and searchable in perpetuity for free. Carol writes, I'm delighted that you have these guests today. Jennifer Malone, you are working on trying to get your mother's dictionary published. Where are you at with that?
We're still finalizing the editing part of it. And hopefully by the end of the month, we're planning on trying to contact someone to be able to get it published.
And Zachary O'Hagan, can you help us understand just how the importance of working to revitalize these languages is also just so intertwined with our understanding of California and who we are as Californians and our history?
Yes, I think especially in areas of the world where there was not, where there are no written records from before the invasion of Europeans, our understanding of how and where languages were spoken and how they were related to each other is often a huge window into the history of the state of California, but of all regions in the world where you apply these kinds of methods. And I'll say that.
Yes. Well, thanks for saying that. And Phil Albers, I want to go to you for just a last thought. There are many things that I was struck by in terms of your description. I'd asked you the question about language maintenance and cultural maintenance, but I was curious to also hear from you about how language has been intertwined with your own sense of identity as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't catch that last part.
Just in terms of how you've talked about how being able to speak Karuk always felt so much more, Karuk always felt so much more like you being yourself, that it helped you understand yourself. And I was just curious what you meant by that, how it has informed your own identity.
Oh, yeah. As mentioned before, I think language is incredibly critical to understanding your own identity. And I refer to that as a cultural identity. But for me, the way that I can process thoughts, emotions, and actions is more consistent with how the Karuk language is processed, how you formulate statements, the way that they're not, and I'm not binding that to grammar or specific subject verb order in that context, but just simply being able to see something with the detail or the process of you go here and then here and that leads to here. For me, the Karuk language really embraces that for how I think and how I process things. So well, it really comes in a line.
It was beautiful hearing it today. Phil Albert of the Karuk tribe, Jennifer Malone of the Pachamni tribe, Karina Luna Geary of the Mutsun and Tamian Ohlone heritage. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.